Gutflix is the streaming platform for digestive health professionals. Discover curated GI content on IBD, hepatology, endoscopy, and more, as well as expert courses, UEG Week recordings, and podcasts personalized to your clinical interests. Start exploring at gutflix.eu. Welcome to UEG Podcast, where we talk about scientific discoveries, educational insights, and professional development within the world of digestive health. Whether you're a clinician, researcher, or just passionate about GI content, this is the podcast for you.
So we're back again with Professor Alex Straumann, and we're talking on the second part about rise and fall of eosinophilic esophagitis. Welcome back, Professor. Professor, we left at the treatment options and we reached a consensus that we're starting with topical steroids and then maybe do some experimentation with the food. But the thing is that the deep remission can only be achieved in, let's say, 10% of the patients. So what can we offer to the vast majority of the rest?
The problem is you is food allergy. And as soon as your esophagus surface is exposed to this, to the culprit protein, the symptom, you have a relapse. That means you need a long-term treatment. Deep remission, I understand, no symptoms, no inflammation over a prolonged period without any treatment does not exist.
Yeah, it's incurable. It's written like this in the literature.
It's not curable. That's correct. Yeah. Either you treat it with diet or you treat it with drugs, with topical steroids or with biologics, but you have to follow this over months, years, years. As soon as you stop it, the relapse is programmed. We have so far no hints that EoE can be cured.
That's not very optimistic.
Yeah.
So it can be managed.
Yes, exactly.
So if we are able to achieve the remission, what happens afterwards in the short term? Do you discontinue treatment and then see what happens, or you continue it indefinitely? What's your approach to this?
We have to inform the patient that it needs a long-term management. And if you have a remission under an ongoing treatment, we have to move forward with this treatment, with this efficient therapy. And we have to control the patients depending on the situation in half a year, on 1 year, and to see. And if the patient is not anymore motivated to move forward with that, either medication or the diet, then we have to stop, but we have to inform that the relapse will come within sometimes few days, sometimes few weeks, but for sure within few months.
Professor, what do you do when you achieve histological remission, but there are still severe symptoms because they are discordant? What do you do with the symptoms? How do you address those?
We have two reasons for symptoms, for problems with swallowing solid food. One is if the inflammation is still active. But if the inflammation is gone, then it is likely the remodeling. Because a chronic eosinophilic inflammation is a strong stimulus for fibrosis, a wall thickening of the esophagus, a loss of distensibilities, and this is a second reason for a transport problem. One reason is the inflammation itself, the other is the remodeling of the organ. And in this situation, a dilation is helpful. We perform a so-called bouginage, and then almost always the symptoms decrease. First step, treat the inflammation. And if the inflammation has gone and the symptoms persist, then we make a dilation of the esophagus. Step by step, carefully, we use this bouginage because we can start with a small diameter and we don't risk injuries of the esophagus. We can do it gentle, step by step, and the final goal is to have a diameter of the esophagus of at least 16 millimeters.
Oh, that's fair enough. The professor, okay, these are the patients that either we achieve symptoms and or histological remission, and then we most probably maintain the treatment in regards to patient wishes. But what do we do with the patients where we cannot achieve neither histological nor a clinical remission? What can we offer them?
If both symptoms and inflammation persist, then we have to change the anti-inflammatory treatment. Standard are topical acting corticosteroids. Then we have to switch to biologics and IL-13 blockade with dupilumab is the alternative. In our cohort of several hundred EOA patients, we achieve the treatment goals with topical corticosteroids in about 80% of the patients. And if we don't achieve both goals, then we use dupilumab.
And the success rate in this case is?
Almost 100%.
Yeah. Okay, so it's not that dire.
But as I said, about 20% of the patients need biologics, need dupilumab. The huge difference is the price.
Indeed.
Topical corticosteroids are not for free, but the costs are about $7 per day. But if you need a biologic, then you have roughly more than $30,000 per year. It's another category. And therefore, we reserve this for severe diseased patients or for patients with a severe allergic comorbidity. If a patient has, in addition, a severe asthma or an allergic rhinitis with a polyposis of the sinus or a severe atopic dermatitis, then it makes sense to use the biologics. Then you have two or even three flies per one batch because you act systemically and not only topical.
And talking about systemic and interleukins, if one opens the scheme about eosinophilic esophagitis, there are so many interleukins, signaling molecules, and so many targets. So do you think that we could steal concepts from allergies to develop new treatment modalities?
Yes.
Which ones?
We have two things we can copy from the allergists, because allergists use for atopic dermatitis and the skin and the esophagus have many similarities. We can copy first the topical way to treatment. Dermatologists use ointments. We use liquids. But topical access, we have both. And second, the same drugs acting for atopic dermatitis, we can use for EOE as well. Not only steroids, but for instance, calcineurin inhibitors. Yeah, we can look to dermatologists. What is successful in atopic dermatitis? Topical treatment. And we can copy.
Copy paste.
Esophagus, yes.
So having said that there are avenues to copy that would potentially would be successful, where do you see the future in managing EOE?
Let's say the unmet needs. Today, it's extremely cumbersome to figure out the culprit food. I would be absolutely happy to have a test, an allergic test. We can see that in patient X, This food is the trigger, the culprit food in patient epsilon. It is this one. Today, we have to make a diet 3 months, exclude this, exclude that, and to ask for the symptoms, to scope the patient. And this is really, it's time consuming, it's costly, it's cumbersome. I would be happy if we had tests to figure out. I would be happy if we could induce a tolerance with an immunotherapy. But so far, we have no hints that an immunotherapy could be successful in EOA. But if we could immunize the patients, if we knew it's milk or it's gluten or it's soy, and we could induce a tolerance with immunotherapy, this would be great. And then, based on the crucial question, why did EOE not exist 50 years ago? I have the concept in my head that industrialized food production is the critical point to increase the allergenicity of the food. If you see the modern milk production, if you see the modern wheat production, I think this is the backside of the medal, that now, based on these new techniques, the food is more, has an increased allergenicity. And if you could move back this to the traditional production method, it could solve the problem.
Well, that's a big aim. So, Professor, you already divulged one of your tips and tricks of how you reveal the actual symptom burden in the patients and how they conspicuously hide their symptoms. But do you have any other tips and tricks to guide your EOE management?
Monitoring the symptoms. We have validated questionnaires, but this is complex. I don't like it. But we offer the patient a visual analog scale from 0, right, completely free of symptoms. I can eat a sandwich without any mineral water. And 10, I never would eat dry rice. I never would eat a steak and so on. And then we ask the patient within this 0 to 10 scale, where would you locate you today? And the other critical, because all the maneuvers the patients develop, they drink a lot, they chew carefully, this reduce the velocity of eating. And we ask, if your original eating speed, eating velocity was 100 kilometers per hour, on which level are you? Then we receive very precise answers. I would think 65. Then we start treatment. 2 months later, we ask the patient, now I'm on 80 kilometers per hour. They easily can understand. But you have to make it intra-individual, because the eating speed has a huge variability. Some are very fast and others are very slow. And there you cannot say compared with your colleagues. You have to ask before EOE started, your velocity was 100 kilometers per hour. And now today you are on which level? This is the easiest way to monitor the symptoms.
These are good. I will definitely try those the next time I encounter these patients. Professor, thank you so, so much. It was a huge honor and pleasure to have you with us, and an incredible journey that you had. You're the only other person to have seen it from just histopathologists screaming at you that what are you doing with the eosinophil esophagus to current advancements. So thank you so, so much for sharing this with us.
Egle, I have to say thank you. You prepared it very well and we could laugh together. It was great. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Professor. I hope this was useful for our audience and we will see you in the next one.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Have a nice afternoon. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to UEG Podcast. We hope you found some new ideas, insights, and inspiration to take with you. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you like our content, please leave us a review and share our podcast with your colleagues.
Enjoyed this episode? You can also find it on Gutflix, the streaming platform for digestive health professionals. Discover expert courses, UEG Week recordings, and podcasts, all personalized to your clinical interests. Visit gutflix.eu and start your GI learning experience.